and welcome to Worlds Apart. As above, so below. This principle, central to many ancient belief systems and almost forgotten in this day and age, postulates that social conflicts will inevitably find their reflection in our individual souls, and vice versa, our daily joys and struggles invariably shape the societies we live in. With that in mind and at heart, what can truly make the world a better place? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Darshan Narvaez, Professor of Psychology Emerita at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of Restoring the Kinship Worldview. Professor Narvaez, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as a psychologist, I'm sure you've been dealing primarily with the microcosm of a human soul, but we live in such precarious times that I want to start with a macro question, because social sciences claim that we know more than we ever knew about the nature of the human condition, about what makes human human. And yet, if we look around us, we tend to be on the precipice of so many potential catastrophes, from ecological to economic to, well, some would claim nuclear. How do you explain that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we've become a civilization, a global civilization that relies on disconnection. And so that starts from early life, when babies are treated with disconnectedness, as if they're more like machines or plants rather than growing dynamic beings. And then that continues with schooling that ignores their heart and intuition development, their embodied wisdom of living in the earth, and pushes them into the intellect or the thinking mind. And then adults think that's the way humans are, that reason is the, you know, and will, that's all you need. And so then we have a whole system, sets of systems that focus on analyzing that way of being, and missing that our whole heritage is about connectedness, mm-hmm. connectedness to self, connectedness to others, connected to the natural world. And when you're disconnected and have this kind of onlooker perspective of subject versus objects, you're going to be destructive, because you have no sense, no heart, no relational awareness mm-hmm. of what you're doing.
Now, I think all human societies across history have tried to find that balance between dignity and connection, between, you know, the individual and the collective, between an individual soul and the whole. And I think many cultures have different answers to that. Even now, when you say we, and when you refer to modern societies, do you mean the entire universe, or, you know, all countries, all cultures, or do you mean somebody in particular?
Well, I'm referring to civilization in general, what we call Western civilization, which has sort of dominated the globe. And it's, from the Enlightenment perspective of just detaching from responsibility, relational responsibility. But we still have societies that operate on our ancestral needs and relational connection orientation. So I study nomadic foragers, and we spent 99% of our history in this kind of society, and only one small percentage of the last 1% of our existence have we gone in this very crazy direction, insane direction, where we're not attending to the effects of our actions, or and then focusing on thinking, the thinking mind, and controlling. That's very counter to the way the dynamic living world works.
Now, you suggest in your book that this is primarily the function of the ego, that it is an egocentric world that tries to control everything. And I think evolutionarily it makes sense, because the world is insecure, and the Enlightenment civilization or the Enlightenment era tried to sort of extol the you know, the beauty of consciousness or the development of consciousness. But I agree with you totally that it's done so at the cost of interrelatedness and connection to something that is bigger than the ego, or something that I think you call the pervasive life force. Other people refer to as God. We can describe it as the universe. But that sense of, you know, that there's something bigger than ego that actually exists, I mean, and manifests itself in the world. Why do you think the Western civilization is so determined at doing away with that? Because one thing I would point out is that in many cultures, be it Russian, Chinese, many Asian cultures, Indian culture, you know, there's a huge respect for something like that, and it's seen as life-sustaining. And yet it's in many of the Western countries where the belief in something bigger than you is seen as almost infantile.
Yes, that's the thinking mind. Ian McGilchrist talks about the two halves of the brain and the left hemisphere, which is what we've been emphasizing in the Western civilization, is unable. When if you look at damaged brains, or if you numb one side of the brain or the other, you find that the left brain is this. It's what we see in our civilization, dominant civilization today. It's the disconnectedness, the treating the world like a set of objects. That's all it knows how to do. And my work focuses on how we treat young babies. And when we treat them with disconnectedness, when we don't respond to their needs, we leave them to cry, we leave them alone, we don't carry them around all day long, which is what they need to grow well, because they're so immature. They're like fetuses of other animals till about 18 months of age. And so they need their needs met immediately to build that connectedness, that because their brains are so immature, only 25% of adult size or volume at birth, typically. So when we mistreat them, which I call undercare, we don't provide the evolved nest, our ancestral species normal way of raising kids, you're now going to, you're breaking, you're stressing, you're traumatizing the child, you're breaking connection. They don't grow what's supposed to be growing. And then they have to build this big ego in order to protect themselves from all that pain and from the disregard, the disrespect that they experience. And so then you have all these adults who are really are arrested development. They're more like toddlers or children because they never got their needs met, and they still are searching restlessly to meet those that gap in their heart, their gap in their spirit.
Okay, Professor, can I argue with you here a little bit? Because I think most school of thoughts recognize that it's impossible to become a fully functioning individual without being traumatized in some way or shape. I mean, even in the most loving families, kids get traumatized, and some would argue that it's you know, it's an indelible part of human condition. I know you believe that many Western societies operate on this trauma-inducing perspective, but isn't your argument also doing that in a way? Because if you only focus on what have been done to you as a child, rather than what you can do to yourself, for yourself as an adult, aren't you becoming essentially stuck in the trauma?
Well, right. So you need to work on healing yourself as much as possible. But there are sensitive periods for different aspects of brain development and neurobiological development that pass. And if you haven't received the nurturing care at that time, you're going to not be as strong in those elements. And so then when you reach adolescence, for example, you'll have depression, anxiety, because the gaps of the brain, because it's developing still, now it's apparent. Things aren't built correctly, and so things start to fall apart under stress. So we need, as adults, to learn how to heal ourselves. And my book on neurobiology and the development of human morality has the longest chapter about what to do if you didn't get your needs met as a young child when all these things were being built.
Mm-hmm. The reason I'm asking this question is because before the war in Ukraine, I used to interview a lot of Americans and American activists, and they always stress this identity and trauma aspect, especially many of the Black activists. And it's not that I don't value or appreciate their suffering, but I'm absolutely convinced that we all suffer in our own ways. And there no one's trauma is more valuable than somebody else's trauma. It's ultimately our responsibility before ourselves to, you know, see it and address it in ways that we can do. And the American approach to it seems to be dealing with it through pharmacological means, sometimes through, you know, very short analysis. But I wonder if there are any other ideas that you can offer, not only to the Americans, but to our global audiences. Can you do it? Can you give that gift to yourself without perhaps having a lot of money?
Right. Let me point out that from birth to about 6 years old is really a sensitive period. And that in that time period, traditionally, we provide the needs of the child. We don't traumatize them because the trauma that you experience in those years is really hard to heal. And I
but it's possible, right? It is possible. And there are many instances of people doing that.
Not really. It depends on what it is, because your immune system is being established at that time. The way your neurotransmitters work are being established. Really hard to change those kinds of things. Very physiological, unless you're meditating for 8 hours a day. So you can do some of the healing. It's those early periods. And one of our most famous psychologists in the United States came from a Soviet background, Yuri Bronfenbrenner. Mm-hmm. And he noted how in the United States, children have all these random kinds of experiences growing up. Whereas in Russia, where he grew up, people love their children. They were so kind, and even the community would always be responsive to the children that they met. So different in the United States, where it's, you know, they're a pain in the neck, young children, you know, keep them quiet, put them away, don't minimize their needs. So we have this taboo on tenderness in the United States. We've exported it now to the world because of multinational corporations. And we've then damaged the belief that babies need to be nurtured and cared for and loved. And so you've got a whole bunch of traumatized people all over the world with post-traumatic stress disorder that don't know how to heal. Now, the ways to heal is to build that connectedness. So we each as adults need to learn to listen, to see, to honor the presence of one another, to actually share our hearts and learn how to do that and be and spend time together in loving ways. Now, I think you can also, as an adult, blame, you know, oh, the way I'm that way because of my trauma. And I think that's not what we want. We want the healed, the awareness that we come from trauma, that are generational, multiple generations of trauma. The Europeans who came to the Americas were traumatized. They were, you know, they brought it and they spread it all over the world now. So we have to go back to understanding how you build a human being properly, how you heal, and an ongoing way of relating to others that's respectful, that honors their uniqueness, and not treat people like objects.
I hope we can discuss more of that after a short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
У каждой аварии, у каждой ошибки, у каждой катастрофы обязательно есть фамилия, имя и отчество.
Greater Finland to the Urals. The Nazi theory of racial superiority, Finnish style. 4 years of Karelian SSR occupation. 14 concentration camps. 34 prisoner of war labor camps. 10 prisons.
В Карелии был геноцид против русского народа. В чистом виде. Они все население поделили на две части. Привилегированное карело-финское население и русское население.
Approximately 25,000 people went through the archipelago of Finnish camps, according to official figures.
Здесь был штаб, там были ворота. Это вся территория лагеря.
Мария, наша сестра, Надя Ростовцева, Генка Костромин. Я вот.
Famine, disease, forced labor, torture by the wardens.
Трупы умерших вывозили на подводах 2-3 раза в неделю. От 25 до 30 гробов за один раз.
Мы до сих пор не знаем точные цифры погибших вообще на территории Карелии, даже Петрозаводского концлагеря.
Thousands of testimonies of crimes and the impunity of criminals.
Нас голыми выгоняли на улицу, садились перед нами надзиратели и фотографировались на память. Это писали люди, которые были там. Это свидетельские показания. И подтверждение того, что это было.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dasha Narvaez, Professor of Psychology Emerita at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of Restoring the Kinship Worldview. Now, Professor Narvaez, before the break, you were talking about, you know, the need to respect the trauma without perhaps, you know, turning it into a cult, you know, understanding your difficult history, but also claiming some responsibility for your health and for your well-being. And one of the things that, I mean, and it's a controversial view, but I think whenever I am in the United States, I sometimes feel that trauma is not only sort of supported there because of the way of life, and there are no perfect society. I would not idealize Russia in this regard as well, because I think in this country, the collective factor has been historically stressed at the expense of the individual selfhood. But having said that, I often get an impression that in Western societies, trauma is being capitalized on. It's sort of being used as a means of production. You know, in many capitalist societies, it is something that is seen as a means of making money, you know, using people's trauma, hijacking it, making them addicted to certain substances and perpetuating this cycle more and more. Can you talk about that, you know, purposeful creation of neurosis as a means of, you know, sustaining trauma versus, you know, authentic grief and, you know, facing with your trauma face to face?
Yes, it's a common problem in what's called high modernism, this Enlightenment fueled way of looking at the world to try to categorize things and then label them and then control them, right? And so it's in psychology, it's in every field. And it is it's a problem because once you have a label, then you feel like you have to be that way and you can't get out of it. When you apply labels to young children, they often enter a reputation track and they can't escape. And so they can't really be themselves when they have a label, right? So the healthy society treats each person as a unique individual, not as a label, not as a category, and honors that unfolding of the beauty of that individual.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of talk in psychological circles about the problem of narcissism, and it's called the new pandemic. And I wonder if narcissism in and of itself is a direct consequence of the Enlightenment worldview, because once you sort of only recognize the material world and nothing else, isn't that something that would foster seeing everything else and everybody else as essentially a functional means to your fulfillment? I guess my bigger question is about the exclusion of, you know, the bigger universe from the Enlightenment view, simply because, you know, there are certain things in this life that cannot be measured. And I think the premise of the Enlightenment worldview is that if it's not measured, then it simply doesn't exist.
Yes, I agree with you. It is an issue that the ego consciousness only knows itself, and the left hemisphere is only wired to know itself. It can't relate to the world. That's what the right hemisphere is able to do. And things are more complicated than that, but it's a representation of how we've shifted into one little tiny bit of humanity and then decided that's all there is, right? And it's the right hemisphere is able to connect to the universe, to relational empathy and all. And when we undermine early childhood development, we are undermining those capacities, because that's when the right hemisphere grows more rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the reasons the ego is doing that is because it's ultimately insecure, even though it pretends to be in control. And this is, I think, what you call the dominance mindset. In your book, The Kingship Worldview, you suggest that, you know, there are certain ways that promote dominance, and then there are other ways that promote wellness. And as a student of archetypal psychology, I'm very tempted to frame it as the king or the wounded king versus the kin mindset. Can you elaborate on that? Why there has to be such a division into black and white, into win or lose with nothing in between?
Well, we try to not have that binary view of the world. It's the left hemisphere, or that ego consciousness, that does that, right? It sorts things into one or the other, either or. Whereas life is a dynamic flow. It's a shift. And sometimes you need a hierarchy. And sometimes, most of the time, you don't want it. In our heritage, we were fiercely egalitarian. That's how it's called. And so there are shifts between things. It's the rigidity of the civilization or ego consciousness that is a problem, right? Because it's unable to move off of those binaries.
There is a major rise in alexithymia, this clinical condition, not only in Western societies, but increasingly so in Eastern societies as well, that is characterized by sort of the freeze of the feeling function and the difficulty in distinguishing between bodily sensations and feelings. I think in your book, you offer many ways on how to sort of bring that apparatus back into human life. Can you share some of them?
Yeah, so in early life with a baby, you want to be face-to-face relating to them so that they actually are building the brain capacities to get along with others and understand their feelings. They learn from their experience. What a baby experiences is what they become. As adults, we're going to have to do a lot of therapy, right? If we have the lack of those capacities. And that, again, is the face-to-face relational attunement, learning to recognize self. You know, you have to build, you've had your heart cut off, perhaps, your spirit, your intuitions, and you have to build those up again and then learn to get along with others. Mm-hmm. I use folk song games in my classes so that children, the students, learn how to, you know, be with one another, for build a sense of social joy and capacity to get along, and then expand their imagination about how they're connected to the universe.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned being one-on-one with nature, and I personally found this an amazing way of doing that kind of work, even without the, you know, psychotherapist, because, you know, in Russia, we have a different kind of narcissism because of our war past. Many of our ancestors, you know, our grandmothers, grandfathers focused on the actual survival of the child, you know, feeding him, you know, taking care of him. And that's also a form of narcissism, because you're essentially treating a kid as an object that has to survive rather than a living human being. And that suppresses many of the emotions. And I think at a certain point, they didn't even have time for emotional exchanges. But one thing that I found very helpful in my own path is just being one-on-one with nature and allowing nature to heal you. Because, and this is one of the other things that you mentioned in your book, the universe, the nature is cooperative. It wants you to be, you know, enjoying this life, and it will help you if you allow that to happen.
Yes, it's so wonderful to be able to go out into a semi-wild or wild nature and just sit there and listen to the trees and learn to build that receptive intelligence and that comfort that the earth gives you. Just lie on the earth, earthing, we call that, right? And your cortisol levels, your stress levels go down, right? And there are many ways to connect to nature. We've done some research on that as well. So yes, I think that's everyone can do something like that. Even in a city, pay attention to the clouds, the sun, the dandelion, or the grass in the pavement, mm-hmm. and you can connect.
Now, you've written a lot about the so-called embodied morality, and I think this is a challenging concept for many people to understand, because we usually associate morality with something mental, something that people, you know, declare from a pulpit, something that they preach without necessarily practicing it. What are some of the ways of cultivating embodied morality?
Yes, and that's what I focus on in multiple books about how the early life experience, again, is that baby feeling the empathy of the parents and then developing their own empathy. They are learning, they're shaping their body to be socially attuned to others. Mm-hmm. And so as adults too, we can learn again to be in our bodies mm-hmm. right now, be present now, wherever you are, and connected. Wherever we are, we're in a web of relationships. Pay attention to those relationships now. Are you being respectful? Are you being attuned to those you're with? And that means, you know, to appreciate the water mm-hmm. that you're given from Mother Earth. Mother Earth is giving you so many gifts. The sun is a gift, right? The sunshine. So pay attention. Mm-hmm. Be now, be present.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm myself an avid and very humble student of Carl Jung, and he wrote a lot about how morality is not something that can be imposed by society. And I think he would even question your premise that the childhood experience is has so much weight. I think in his view, the traumas that we receive as children are important, but there are ways of overcoming them, primarily because in his view, again, we are not only the creatures of the past. There is a certain sort of forward-looking function within us, within the universe, that wants to us to heal, and that constantly pushes us externally and internally in that direction. Now, it's a very daunting and at the same time a very inspiring task, because essentially the premise of that argument is that you will have, regardless of what happened to you, you will have to do the work to sort of recover what is underneath the trauma. And this is something that I want to ask you about. Is there something underneath the trauma? Do you think it's worth looking below it?
Well, let me just say first that we are living in civilization that is trauma-inducing. We forgot the pathway to wellness. So the wellness pathway is a multiple kind of layered system to building our full potential as human beings. And I think we just sort of forgot that, and we do so many things that undermine wellness. And so I think you have to be careful not to just go back into thinking mind, right? And saying, oh, well, you can do whatever it is to heal yourself and it's all in your head.
Not really. You have to feel it here and perhaps even down below.
Yes. So we're holistic. We want to heal the gut, the brain too, but the heart especially. That's where we connect. And we know the heart has all sorts of things, influences on how we think, right? And the gut also, we have the gut-brain axis now. And the ways that our ancestors raised children made it all work well, made it all fit into the earth and the system and the dynamism of being a member of the earth community.
I began with that Gnostic phrase that as above, so below. So I believe deeply that, you know, the individual work also helps the society. But I wonder if you believe that we will ever reach that golden age where most people on this planet understand who they are, not what they're being shaped into, but who they are truly intrinsically within, you know, their bodies. Or do you think the time will run out before we can actually get to that glorious point?
Yes, it's a challenging question because the climate instability and disruption that's going on is quite distressing. It won't take much more to really make a hothouse earth. But I am an optimist in terms of what the potential is for humanity. And I think that sometimes our ideas, like the collective unconscious, is like a virus, and then everybody changes, right? And we are in complex systems, and just little changes around the edge can shift the whole thing. So that's what I pray for. I hope for that we can all return to being connected, to mm-hmm. feeling connected to everyone around the planet.
Mm-hmm. And I want to stress that your books offer several very practical and very easy to do ways. I mean, it does not guarantee you, the full healing. That's what ego would ask for guarantees. But there are certain ways that each one of us can do to feel a little bit better one-on-one with yourself and with the world. So thank you very much both for the books and for this conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.
We'll be right back.